and welcome to the DM's Book Club, a weekly podcast where we talk about some Dungeons and Dragons and then how we can fit it into our role-playing campaigns. With me doing some weird mime act is Fiona.
You know, I did forget how we do the intro there, so I did a dragon instead of a dungeon. I did some fighting.
It you was doing some boxing, I think.
I do some boxing, yeah. Well, how are you, Hamilton? How have you been?
I've been good. Busy as ever, really. Mm-hmm.
Classic.
Yeah, looking forward to, more than anything, our Baldur's Gate game tonight as our weekly Tuesday night thing. How about yourself? You've been improving it up, haven't you?
I've been improv. Yeah, been lots of improv, which is good. Some little bit of admin. So as I say off podcast, my heart rate was quite high. It's now quite low, so it's all good. Just getting on with things, really. And, doing some planning and stuff. You know, obviously we're chugging through other Travel Book Club slowly but surely, and I'm enjoying reading the rest of the planes on that, so that's been really good. So yeah, it's just chugging along, really. I think I know this is like the 50th year of D&D, and there's like, you know, there's stuff happening. Like the Vecna adventure has been announced. It looks very exciting. It's coming out, I think, in April, it said, and we've seen the alt cover as well, which looks pretty phenomenal. And D&D is sort of chugging along in the background whilst life is going on, but I'm doing all right otherwise.
Good. So D&D is 50 years old, you say, but we're going to be going back to nearly that far ago, probably 40-odd years, so only 10 years, less than 10 years into its inception, into 1981. TSR at the time was the owners, and The Fiend Folio.
Yes. Tome of creatures, I can't say that word, malevolent and benign. Yeah, because you suggested this a couple of weeks ago to me, and I was like, yeah, sure, sounds good, interesting cover. Reading of the history about it, I was like, this feels quite wild.
It really does. I sent you a video that I saw, YouTubers that predominantly do Warhammer, called Snipe and Wib. They kind of remind me of me and you because they're sort of just like, they kind of do like a book club, but they do it for Warhammer, they do Codex Compliance, so it's kind of like very similar. So one of them is British, one of them is Australian, but the feel of their show. So if you enjoy our show, but also like Warhammer, I do recommend their stuff because it has a similar vibe, if you know
we'll put a link to it in the show notes then, absolutely. Always happy to uplift other people who also are like us
they're
and who aren't
fine.
Experts.
Oh, 50,000 subscribers.
Well, then I won't put a link in the slow notes and sod them. Yeah, absolutely.
No, we should, because it's thanks to watching their stuff that it came up with this chat about the Fiend Folio, because they do some D&D content as well, and other TTRPGs, as well as Model Railways. This talking about the Githyanki, and it was in response to Baldur's Gate 3 and Lazelle, and they just talked about the history of the Githyanki, which was that they came from this Fiend Folio. And they had mentioned in previous iterations where the Fiend Folio had come from, which is the Fiend Factory, which was a part of White Dwarf. Now, White Dwarf, for those who don't know out there, is,
including myself,
Games Workshop's hobby magazine. In the early days, the beginning of White Dwarf, it was very much all about what Games Workshop were doing at the time, which was they being the people who sold and licensed D&D in the UK.
Yeah, and lots of other RPGs as well. It was like the go-to magazine for that sort of things.
They had all the Chaosium ones, so the Call of Cthulhu, and they had some Vampire the Masquerade even. RuneQuest,
I think, was another big one.
Mm-hmm. A magazine that just talked about all of the current things happening in role-playing games, which was, at the time, the hip new thing in the late 70s, early 80s.
Yeah. We had someone on recently, as a bonus episode, we had Gary Coleman of Game Therapy UK, and he said that, that was sort of his inspiration, was getting White Dwarf and, like, having these different, like, homebrew things or things that you could put into any system or any genre. It was just all there, and it just kind of made sense. And now you think it's so odd in a way, because we do have, like, Zines, and we've got stuff like, you know, Weird Science, which does more review stuff.
Yeah.
Obviously, White Dwarf still exists, right? But it's more Warhammer, right? Or am I? I was gonna say, you're gonna pull out one of these.
I'm gonna pull out 1996's one, because I'm doing some stuff for this character that I've got here, which is my Asmodee one. So I had it ready and waiting.
You were so quick with that as well,
because I literally had it for. Yeah. But I've got about 50 of them on my shelves.
But it narrowed its focus to Warhammer.
Yeah, I think
eventually
around 100, issue 100 or something like that. It was then when Games Workshop started making Warhammer Fantasy Battles and Warhammer 40K. Then it now is just a 150 page advert, but always been a very good, like, at the time, and still does, gives you rules for the game and additional things. Like in that one I've got here, for example, inside the middle, it's got some additional cards that you can pull out.
Oh, shoot. Nice.
Like, which give you additional rules for particular kitbashable things.
Oh, cool.
So they were really great. Like, and you get big posters. I've got a big Ultramarines poster that you can pull out from this one.
Put that on your wall.
I don't want Ultramarines.
Put it next to your albums you've got on the back of the wall there.
Exactly. And then also had mail order at the back, which was always very cool.
Of course, mail order. Yeah.
It's like an Argos catalogue mixed with beautiful photos and...
of all the things you want as an adult.
As an adult and a child as well.
You have income now that you can spend it on these things.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. I wish they were like that now, but they still do sell them. This is where the Fiend Factory came from on a little tangent, which is where people at the time just could write in and say, I come up with little homebrew things they've made for Dungeons and Dragons or other games, but the Fiend Factory particular for that. And they would get a free copy of White Dwarf.
Oh, wow.
But that was what they'd get.
That was what they'd get for it.
But at the time, you see it as like, you know, you're writing in to an editor and you know it's just getting published in a magazine.
Yeah. It's a fun little thing, like a hobby thing.
Fun little thing. And then... it becomes slightly more sinister, the story, doesn't it, Fiona?
Yeah, so, and this as far as I've understood it, so the editor of White Dwarf at the time, and managing director of TSR in the UK, got loads of these contributions to the Fiend Folio, and only like a small fraction of them ever got published, because obviously, as you said, like, you know, you can only publish so much, and we're not, obviously, not in the time of the internet where things can just go out immediately. And so, I don't know really if it just was like, we're just going to do this, or maybe, because it does say kind permission to reprint these things. But the Fiend Folio is basically a lot of the contributions to this column that didn't get necessarily published. Some of them
They are ones that were published.
Were they?
I think most of them are all ones that were published.
Because I was going to say, if it was the other way around, that's absolutely wild. You didn't get published, but I'm going to use it for my own book.
Yeah, no, they were the sort of cherry-picked from the ones that were published over a period of about 5 years or something like that.
Fair enough. That's why I was like, whoa, that's really bad. Okay, so printed as the Fiend Factory column, but then they were sort of taken and put into this big sort of book called the Fiend Folio, and Turnbull copy edited them slightly. Some of them, apparently, they only needed a little bit. Some of them needed lots of editing just to bring it up to sort of a standardized form that would reflect with the monster manual that Gary Gygax has sort of created at the same time. In the foreword itself, because I read this sort of thing, first of all, incredibly long foreword for what should realistically be, I've taken other people's work and published it with their permission and edited it, possibly without their permission. And I just want to thank... Gary, I want to thank my lady June at the end of copy editors, and I could thank all the contributors, but I'm not gonna put them here. There's too many of them to name, but they're at the back. They're listed at the back with each individual creature, which I will say is more than the Encyclopedia Magica, which didn't even bother to name any of the contributors for where they came from or where they sourced their stuff from. There's a little bit of where I'm just a bit like, this feels a little bit malicious, or a bit sort of like, we're gonna take this.
Yeah.
It's gone from what I see as a community, like, hey, I'm going to share these ideas through, and then one person's taking it and go, I'm going to put my name to it, or a small group of people to it. Whereas nowadays, you know, when we have anthologies of, you know, adventures, or if you've got like an RPG that's being raising money, everyone is credited. And if you have the title of the module or the title of the creature, whatever, right next to it instantly is the author's name or the game designer's name, rather than hidden away at the back. Again, is that something where I noticed it and was very aware of it? And then just seeing it now and thinking about like the OGL stuff that we had obviously last year, it just instantly left a little bit of a bad taste in my mouth. Now, this is, I was just about to go into it rather than just reading it all, et cetera. But I just instantly, I was like, I don't like how this has come about, and I don't know how to feel about it necessarily.
What I was going to try and do is mention the names of the people when we come to them so that we can do that.
Amazing.
But I totally agree. But then DMs Guild, you know, when you put stuff up there, they have a right now to... I've put my Paladin Oath of the Veiled Shadow on there. I've got my other thing I did, my Spelljammer Cosmic Ganassi. If they wanted to take those and use them, they have every right to do that, and they don't have to pay me anything, which I think... it's a funny place to be in. It's just a funny world that we live in. And as you get older, you slowly realize how much people are, with all the money, seem to make more money all the time. And people particularly passionate about things get left behind.
Yeah.
So it just reminds me particularly of a song by Gillian Welch, which is called Everything Is Free, right? And the lyrics of it go, everything is free now. That's what they say. Everything I've ever done, I'm going to give it away because someone hit the big score. They figured it out that we're going to do it anyway, even if it doesn't pay.
Whoa.
And it's a really great...
Gosh.
And that's from, I think, early 2000s, late 90s song. 2001,
Wow.
But it's a perfect song, and it picks up on this point that what it feels like is slight exploitation of people's passion for a thing.
Yes.
And I think, yes, writing into a fiend factory, great. And you can push it like, you're going to get published. You're going to get this. What are you going to get paid?
Yeah, free copy of White Dwarf, yeah.
For this, they didn't even get a free copy of the Fiend Folio. They supposedly got a gift token for a discount for the Fiend Folio book.
What?
And it was only acceptable in Canada and the UK. And if you weren't in those countries at the time, oh, it's the UK, I think, only. So if you were in Canada, there was a couple of people from Canada who got copies of White Dwarf from the UK. And there were people like that just couldn't even use this voucher.
God.
So they didn't even get a free copy of the book.
That's wild. That's so, because it talks about like they've had contributions from all over the world, from like the US, yeah, the UK, even though it's a UK, yeah, publication.
White Dwarf was published all over around the world, yeah, and especially, yeah, yeah, Australia and New Zealand and,
that's,
and America.
That's so,
yeah,
upsetting.
So
like
upsetting.
You don't even and get a copy of the actual book.
You don't even get a free copy, which, gosh, is not a big deal. And even sending it internationally for the amount of money they made off this book and the Fiend Folio is so famous. And yeah, and then I think what is the most galling is you think, okay, fine, so they're going to just be really weird, random things that we don't know about.
Mm.
The amount of big names,
yes,
that comes out of this book that are now today some of the headline acts of,
yeah,
D&D,
yeah,
is incredible.
I recognize so many names. I was like, oh, I've read about them. I ran them in a game, you know?
How amazing to feel that every time, yeah, you see it, you're like, that's it. But to not have the recognition,
yeah,
and to not be compensated for it is a question that needs to be asked sometimes, you,
yeah,
do think. And there's a lot of names we're going to tick off on this list and you're going to be like, really?
Yeah, it's right. I think maybe it speaks to both you and I who are creative,
yeah,
folks who create content and being so aware that, you know, we want to credit where we've got our sources from because, mm, A, we don't want to be targeted for copyright infringement or anything, yeah, like that. But we also don't, you know, we also want to be like, I did not create this.
Yeah.
I use this person who's excellent. And you should go and, if you want to use that work, go to that. And like for me, and I know it sounds so silly, like in every show notes I ever do for Where and for DM's Book Club, I always put a list of all the music I've used, even the sound effects, even if they're Creative Commons public domain. Mm. Because like some people are like, that's a really good thing. Where did you find that? And if I go, I don't remember, that's really poor on me. And that shows that I'm not a professional. But yeah, reading this now, I'm just like, God, this, it just feels like a bit of hand waving.
It really does. You think maybe it's because it's a different time and it's such an early days and the money made in D&D maybe wasn't as high. I don't know. But still, I think this, yeah, wouldn't happen today.
And if it did, there would be a massive uproar about,
exactly,
it.
Exactly.
I want to say before we move on to actually, we'll go on to actually some of the creatures that you and I have sort of picked out as ones to sort of look at. So I just did want to catch one thing, and I just wanted to get your sense check on it because I feel like I've misread it a little bit. So right at the end of the foreword, and I'll read it out in its total, and I just want to hear what you think of it. I will make only one apology in respect to the Fiend Folio. You have to say that because it's all in capitals. And it is this. There are many, many places in the text where it is necessary to refer to a person, for instance, the victim of a monster's attacks, who is not identified as to gender. In such places, it is tempting, though I believe unnecessary pedantic, to lapse into the cumbersome and ugly style of he or she, him or her, and other such awkwardness. And then in brackets, it says, the English language has not yet bent to accommodate these alleged requirements of modern society. And if such products are to be the words of himmer or hiser, I devoutly hope it never will. Earlier in the proceedings, I decided to eschew such clumsiness, and if there is a reader who is offended by this, it is to him that I apologize. Or, of course, to her. Let me confirm that unless there are specific contextual indications to the contrary, all references in this book to males apply equally to females. Now, I assume it's just because, like, often in those sort of books, it talks about, like, oh, he is the player, he is this, he is that.
They has been around for such a long time.
Yeah.
It's been used for hundreds of years. We have a genderless plural, genderless singular and plural. And
yeah,
so, unlike, as you know, I'm learning Spanish. In Spanish, you do not have a genderless plural. You have ellos and ellas, and it is male or female, masculine, feminine. And if you want to talk about both, you can use the masculine. Is always,
yeah,
you know, and like parents is just dads. Do you know what I mean? You can just,
yeah,
call,
yeah,
them dads. You know, it's stuff like that. We fortunately have a term which has been around, and the fact that really gets me on this sentence, and I'm glad you picked it up, they've made the effort,
yeah,
to know it's an issue. and to then ignore it completely.
That paragraph is one of many, which is a very verbose, like, almost as if they're giving a speech sort of thing. All it needs to say is, like, we're just going to refer to the monsters as they for all out the thing.
Exactly.
Why are we going into so much detail about this?
Feels like someone who has an axe to grind. Apologies. I'm sure you're probably a nice person, but there's a lot of baggage coming with this book. This is 1981. We go to 1994 and we hit the Planescape books. And they kind of mix and match between her. Every adventurer is always female. Something else is sometimes male or female. And then they kind of mix it up. And I think the sort of overcorrection that way at the time was a really inspiring move. Agreed, you know, they would be a much better thing. The thing is, why not do that? That's a better thing to do, which is about trying to encourage people of other genders to come than men to come in, or male presenting to come into the game.
What a way to start a book that is so famous, you know?
Caveating a lot of, like, this is written in 1981.
Yes, legacy content.
If you do go and find this book, just be prepared for that, obviously. But it's a fascinating read. Should we start by just mentioning some of the big names?
Yeah. Firstly, I counted them all.
Yeah, well done.
I know. Woo. There is 160 entries into this Fiend Folio. So we've got them all in alphabetical order. But yeah, you look down and you see stuff. So instantly, I know one we're going to talk about is Arakocra. Yeah. We've got stuff such as Bullywug as well.
Yeah. Tabaxi, Svirf Neblin, Nilbogs, Slard, all the elemental princes of evil. All the types of mephits, which we talk about a lot in the elements, a lot of elemental stuff. Kuotoa, Kenku, Hook Horrors, Grells, Flumps, favorite of ours.
Flumps.
As well as just a bunch of other ones that you will see, but those are the bigger ones, you know, like, and Githyanki and Githzerai, as we mentioned.
So rather than going through all 160 entries, because obviously that.
Welcome everyone to 14 hours.
We thought we'd pick some that we thought were interesting, or in my case, rolled randomly for. For you, Hamilton, why did you pick the ones you picked that we're going to discuss it today?
I skim read through the ones, and then I looked at the ones that looked kind of long enough and interesting enough. And then when I read through a bit more, I was like, oh, this is cool and different.
Mm.
Well, one of them I chose is Arakocra, and you've chosen the Githyanki as two big sort of playable species in D&D that I think it's good to see their origins.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking about Tabaxi, but I thought there was more on the Arakocra. Also, it's at the beginning, so I'd read it.
First entry.
And then I've chosen two, which, surprise, surprise, are actually from the same creator, which is kind of interesting.
Oh, really? How interesting.
But not surprisingly, because they're both actually very, what would say normally be Fiona.
I did think to myself, you picked ones which you would mistaken that I've picked these ones.
I think it's because I've been playing too much Warhammer. I've gone all emo again, and now I just want, but I thought they were really interesting and a different play on things. And I thought, from my point of view, really cool DM's book club. And so I thought, as a DM, two very interesting DM heavy sort of monsters to use, or player options in some respects, to be honest, I think could be like, as a, you know, a fun, like, one could be an end to someone's story and one could be the beginning to another story, or part of a character who wants to play a character for a bit in a campaign and then leave or change up later on, you know, could be a bit of fun. I've chosen Arakocra, how to pronounce this?
Yes, I was literally trying to look it up myself.
Penangalan,
I believe it, yes.
And a Revenant.
Yes.
The Revenant and the Penangalan were made by Stephen Hellman, and the Arakocra was designed by Lawrence Schick. And what have you chosen then?
Yes, I feel like, because I wanted to mention the Githyanki, because they are on the cover. And as you sort of rightly put, the reasons of why we're doing this is because they are so influential nowadays, which is so weird, because one of the earliest episodes of the DM's Book Club was me reading about it with obviously our previous co-host Ryan about the GIF war with the Mind Flayers and then the GIF Yankee and GIF Sarai. So I had no clue that they'd come from this Fiend Folio.
Yeah.
So that was fascinating. So I thought, well, might as well mention that, because they are so relevant right now and they're so high profile, which is excellent, I think. And then I did my usual Fiona thing of rolling a random number generator. Well,
you've chosen some good ones.
I was quite surprised, actually. So the other ones I'm going to introduce this is something called a Throat Leech and then a Disenchanter.
Ooh.
Very interested in those.
So the Throat Leech, by the way, is made by Ian Livingston, of the person who invented Games Workshop.
No way. And the fantasy...
Yeah, Choose Your Own Adventure. So that's his. So he was one of the co-founders of Games Workshop. And your other one was the Disenchanter.
Yes.
Which was by Roger Mewson.
we start with our big hitters first? It's almost like Pokemon in a way. Do you want to start with your Aarakocra and then we can go on to the Giffyanki?
Yeah, okay, let's go with that then. We'll go to Aarakocra. So the Aarakocra are called Birdman in brackets. They are very rare. Normally the number that appears are 1 to 10. It has an armor class, which would be equivalent to a 17 in modern standards. And they have a 6 foot movement / 36 movement. I have no idea where 1E works.
So, yes. So I will say at the beginning of this book, it does give you a breakdown about how to read these things. But yeah. Even I'm just there going like, ooh, there's a lot of information here yeah. that you either applies or doesn't apply. So, for example, right at the end, it says like, oh, psionic abilities or attack defense modes. And you're like, yeah. You don't need them for everything.
No, exactly.
And the movement stuff, yeah, it sort of says like, the movement speed on the left side of the bracket is their sort of normal medium yeah. rate. And then after, if it's 1/, it is their flying in addition to the normal thing. And then 2/ is swim speed. If it's in brackets, it's burrowing speed. And then if it's quotation marks, it is speed in a web in addition to moving. So I believe it will be flying speed
Love
if it's
it.
On the other. That's what, again, who knows? But that's what I got from there. Again, you think, just say, walking speed, flying speed.
Yeah, it's fine. They're trying to make it easy for themselves, maybe. I don't know.
Maybe.
But it talks about the Aarakocra as a much more tribal species of creatures instead of being more of like a humanoid that we see today yeah. as like a playable character. Mm-hmm. So obviously this is more of a fiend monster folio. So they're sort of putting them more as not so antagonistic. They are neutral good alignment as in the terminology of that. Obviously, alignment is a whole thing, you know,
yeah.
that everyone can be anything within that. But I think what I mean by that is they're not something, I think it's like, will they attack on sight? No, sort of thing.
Yes, yeah.
They are very separate from human existence and sort of societies. They all in this exist in the peaks of mountains where they soar all day on the winds and the thermals.
Mm.
They live in groups of about 11 to 30 and they have a hunting territory of about 10,000 square miles. So they get traveling and it kind of puts them very much closer to like, talks very much about how their relationship with giant eagles and they can communicate with giant eagles. So they have mutual respect for one another, as they say.
Mm.
And they are actually a bit more demure and stout in height. They're about 5 foot high, but they have a yeah. wingspan of about 20 foot.
Yeah, they're very much like pterodactyls.
Yeah.
Or sort of describes them as, but obviously feathered rather than sort of...
Do you know that you can never see a pterodactyl go to the loo?
Why?
Because the pee is silent.
I hate you so much.
Anyway, so they do have those pterodactyls where they have the hands at the end and then they're like pinky finger... is yeah. now like is a really long finger that extends out the wing. And
ooh.
So they have hands which have got three fingers and an opposable thumb, which when they're not flying, they can use. The dexterity isn't, it says, as good as like four. That is, in they might not be as dexterous at doing things, but their foot hands, as they call them,
yeah.
or their nether hands, are equally dexterous with an opposable thumb and they can sit and they do weavings.
Weaving,
and...
yeah. Which, again, this idea that they're all on their back and they're weaving whatever
yeah.
the thing, like these banners and stuff like that.
Yeah, they mark their territory with banners, which just sounds quite lovely.
They're so quick at doing it, which makes me, again, it's that sort of thing going, oh, I need to just do this one craft, 1 second, Hamilton, and then I'll just be on the floor. You see my hands and feet
yeah,
peddling
exactly.
so fast as I do some sort of ball of yarn.
Like a classic, like a cartoon of a cat playing with a ball of yarn, exactly.
That's exactly
yeah.
what I think. Yeah. That, yeah,
yeah,
when I saw it, I was like, a cool, flavorsome thing to describe to your players.
Yeah. And I love this idea. It kind of just evoked like imagery. I saw this thing on YouTube where someone had given hundreds of 3D artists, thousands of them even, and then collated 100 of them of people walking up steps around the column.
Oh,
and then
cool.
they rendered it in their own different way. And they're all beautiful. I recommend it. But it reminded me of that, just thinking of like this big mountain expanse, big oversized nests and these huge banners floating in the wind. You know, like you could kind of imagine it. It's kind of
yeah.
really evocative. So I did
yeah.
love that. And it talks about the fact that if they're going to attack, because they can't use their front hands, their forward hands, because they have to use those to manipulate their flying, they use their nether hands to hold javelins, which they keep on their back, and they'll have about 20 of those, and they will and they will use them to throw, and then they'll leave the last one until they get on the ground, and
yeah,
then
yeah,
if
yeah.
they need it.
Yeah, they don't want to necessarily throw them willy-nilly. They'll come in, they'll charge, they'll come fly in, charge,
yeah.
and then try and stab you. And I'm like, that also sounds awful, because they're so quick in this movement as well. So yeah, if you imagine like a whole squadron of them flying down, and
yeah
so it could be a really terrifying encounter, certainly, if you think. And yeah, in the first edition of D&D, you're like, oh my god, what are these horrific creatures?
Yeah, exactly.
Ooh.
And it says that exactly, they can dive like an eagle, so they can dive all the way down and then lift themselves up last minute, and that's how they utilize that attack motion.
Yeah.
And they have forward-facing eyes, so they're predatory sort of facial structure of a bird of prey.
Mm-hmm. And they can also carry up to 150 GP in weight, which is about roughly 150 pounds.
Which is three times their weight.
Yeah, they are quite light, because again, you think of birds, they are quite light or hollow bones, etc. So it totally makes sense. But that's like, bloody hell. So again, you can imagine if there was a big, I don't know, embassy contingency coming, and that maybe they're all carrying like treasure chests between them or something like that, like, or bringing, I don't know, camping equipment. They could carry a lot of stuff, so it'd be quite impressive.
Oh yeah, so they weigh between 25 and 35 kilograms or 50 to 80 pounds, and they can carry up to 75 kilograms or 150 pounds. So they could carry me. So if I want to go for a flight, I could always ask one. They could just pick me up and go
for a
flight.
You can, and then they'll drop you and then try and stab you with their...
Hopefully not. I think worth noting that they will join an adventurous party if they need to. They have a very extreme claustrophobia, it mentions, which is kind of an interesting little tidbit.
Wow. Yeah.
Where it says that they have a fear of being in closed spaces, that they will not enter a building, and it would only be under serious, desperate measures that they would venture below ground.
I did not catch that. That's really interesting, actually.
But a game called Dungeons and Dragons.
Just And Dragons, it's now called.
The fact that a lot of Arakocra go dungeon delving is interesting now. But I think it could be an interest. I just thinking, if you are going to play an Arakocra, something maybe just that you could add as a flavor to your characterization, as in something that you may, or at least maybe not be aware of until you're in an enclosed space and go, holy shit. You know, if you're playing quite a young Arakocra character, and they only live, it doesn't say in this, but I think they only live about 10 to 15 years or something.
It's a very small amount of time, like actual birds,
Yeah, so if you are an Arakocra playing them, then you could flavor that into your characterization of, I've never been inside a building, I've never been underground, you know, like it could be an interesting part to add to it. So
yeah, I like that.
All around an interesting introduction to them, and I thought it was doing pretty good.
So I really like that flavor. I wouldn't make it as necessary a mechanical limitation or anything like that, but I think it's such a cool thing to think about, is that that if there was a moment that maybe you have to do an extra check to get through a tight space, perhaps, but it's not a disadvantage or a minus penalty or anything like that. But they may need to, I don't know, lose a bonus action. So I don't know. Again, I think you're right. I really like that idea as a suggestion.
Mm.
As always, I'm one of those people that I don't want you to pick a lineage or a species because you think they sound cool. I think looking at like what we're doing the research, going, oh, here's a little bit of history about them.
Yeah.
And how can you bring that into your playing of them as a sensitive way of doing it, but also just means that you've really immersed yourself in the thing rather than going, I like it because they're flying birdmen, you know? So I think that's a little cool thing that they can take in for that.
It just makes you aware of, these are bird creatures. They are people that love flying around in the air with expanse and space to see for distances. Yeah. You know, and very used to looking at distances. And so to then just get you into that headspace, putting that little thing in, even though you don't have to take it mechanically, it's just like, oh yeah, this is how I can engage with this characterization is all. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so. I like that. So Githyanki, many, many millennia ago, the Mind Flayers, which you can find in the Advanced Dungeons & Dragons Monster Manual, because that's where they are, they conquered a race of evil humans, just says quotation marks there, and bound them to service, usually employing them as slaves, but from time to time selecting the particularly choice victims for food. So a wonderful time if you're this particular lineage that was under captivity. They harboured a deep resentment, understandably, towards their captors, but couldn't summon the strength to do so until in secret they started developing these powers and strength. And then under the leadership of a supreme leader called Gif, that is their actual name, they rebelled, and after a long struggle, they managed to break free as a result. And from that moment, they became known as the Githyanki, but then a subsection of them called the Githzerai also broke off because they didn't necessarily agree with what had happened. The difference between them is that, again, this is a massive broad stroke, so I do apologize if it's too broad, but the Githyanki are most likely to be fighters and warriors, less so spellcasters. There will be a couple of them, but not too many. Whereas the Githzerai, they are the ones with more psionic powers. They're the ones that are in limbo. We've talked about it before in a different DM's book club. They're the ones that are able to use the power of their minds to literally form matter and put themselves in places that, you know, they can survive in places which are just constantly changing.
I also like they have this class called the Knights, which is an anti-paladin class.
Yes.
Which is kind of sounds interesting. And as you mentioned, and this is something that still is in the lore, I believe, today for Githyanki, that you will never got a Githyanki that becomes higher than a 11th yet level fighter or 9th level magic user, because their Lich Queen ruler will see them as a threat and eat them or kill them.
Yes, I highly recommend checking out Modern Titans Foes or Foamy Toes, depending on how whatever comes into your head. Because discussing that and be like, oh my god, because everyone doesn't believe that this Lich Queen will do that. They're like, yes, we're doing it for the honor and all that sort of thing. And if you are celebrated and taken away in a big ceremony, and it's not good. I don't think it's an open secret. I think it's just a general sort of thing, like, yes, this is, I am being celebrated. This is what I meant to be. I'm doing it for the glory of the Gith Yankee. They are often found on the astral plane. So very rarely do we find them on the material plane. Again, looking at sort of the quick stats that we got. So it's very rare that you would have sort of encounter with them. If you do encounter them, they're probably going to be either on their own or a very, very small scouting group, which makes sense because the idea that they're going to the prime material plane to find information that they can bring back to the astral plane through their cities and just getting that information, etc. I believe as well that they usually use those reconnaissance missions as a way to gain experience to show their true fighting potential. So they'll do lots of training stuff, and then they'll be sent out on missions, which would make sense. That's very much any kind of training to be a fighter story tropes. You know, they go out and they experience the world. Very helpful, this stat block, because it goes, what's their armor class? Well, it's variable because there's so many different kinds of Githyanki. Yeah. Same with movement, same with hit dice. And you're like, oh, for goodness sake.
Yeah.
There's also this talk about, like, where would we encounter them? And it says, like, 40% of the time they'll be in their lair. And I'm like, well, Githyankis and Githzaris, like, okay, those will most likely be found in where a lot of them would be, which probably is the astral plane or in Githzaris, because the limbo. But it just made me laugh. It's like, it was 40% of the time they'll be in the lair, but 60% of the time they could be anywhere. Like,
yeah, sad about
the alignment variable but always evil, which, like, that feels like I tag myself as, like, I'm a variable alignment but I'm also always evil. They do have psionic abilities as well. And they had this thing about silver swords, which I didn't really capture the whole thing of it, but essentially, let me see if I can find it. I will say a lot of this writing is quite academic, and it's very sort of like, rather than flavorsome, it's giving you the facts in columns, which is a bit hard going, as I would say for myself. A supreme leader will wield a special silver sword, which is a +5, fully vorpal, and affects mind-barred victims. The silver swords are non-aligned, though they have an intelligence of 8 or more and the appropriate powers. Githyanki will almost go to any lengths to prevent these silver swords falling into the hands of humans. And the loss of a special silver sword will promote an immediate formation of a very powerful raiding party of Githyanki, whose task is to recover the sword. Failure to do so means instant death. What a cool plot hook. What a cool thing that, obviously this was before you could do playable characters as Githyanki, but instantly I'm like, you are part of the scouting mission to find this silver sword, or worse, you're the one who lost it. And maybe you're playing those higher character, you know, higher levels, and that's why you're a supreme leader. Or you were tasked, for some reason they died and you had that task to bring back the silver sword and you lost it. I was like, that's a little thing that I would 100% want to use as a character. If the GM was like, what kind of stories do you want to talk about? I think using the silver sword would be a really cool way of putting it in.
Yes, that is really cool. My favorite thing, obviously, though, is the thing that's at the last chapter on the last paragraph.
Oh, is this... this little pact with the group of dragons.
Yeah.
You know, they have a pact with a group of red dragons, which in return for shelter, food, and treasure, assist the Githyanki when on the material plane, acting as steeds, which again, we have seen in Baldur's Gate. You see them in that intro as well.
Yeah, it's amazing.
It's very cool. And I will say again, if you've got a copy of Mordekainen's Tome of Foes, I appreciate it. It has been discontinued because they're like, it's legacy content, which is fair. There are some absolutely cracking bits of art with Githyankis riding red dragons, like, as they're doing their aerial assault on a town. It is primo.
I gotta say, the art in this book at times is a little bit low res, but the page before, in between the Githyanki and the Githzerai pages, is a really cracking one. I love that black and white.
Yes,
one.
They have this almost like a full page of pen artwork, which again must. I don't know. I mean, I know the credit of the artists in this as well. I don't know if that particular art was used in Red Dwarf. Whoops. White Dwarf. They have these little images in general, which I would assume, that's part of the column, so maybe they commissioned an artist to do that. But the actual full panel ones, incredible. There's one with a Grell later on, which is like almost killing, like, it looks like to be a femme presenting warrior. Absolutely. I was like, whoa, that's really good. It's so detailed.
Yeah. And the Grell is scary as ever. I also like, I know you're not doing the Githzerai particularly, but I do like when it comes to layers, it talks very briefly about the Githyanki's layer. Only 5 to 10 magical items, selectors being appropriate for the mission, and a small party of you know, one magic item, and last party will have probably 1 to 10. But then the Gisarai has, like, each layer will have 21 to 36 Gisarai, one supreme leader, one captain, two warlocks, three sergeants, three Zers, 11 to 20 first to 12, second levels of this. And it says maybe a monk, maybe this. And it's kind of like, that's your combat encounter and your layer source it, and it was quite good for that.
If you're able to quickly read this and get used to obviously reading it, then yeah, you can easily come up with like, I'll just take this and tweak it a little bit as soon as they go, oh, they've met these creatures. I completely agree with that. There is definitely, yeah, it is like the quick build that you see, but this is like quick encounter build. This is what you get, and then being able to factor it up.
But what is interesting is I've always seen the Gisarai and Githyanki as similarly portrayed visually, like facially as well. Mm-hmm. But in this, the Gisarai have a very different appearance to the Githyanki. The Githyanki, you can see how they're taking on a sort of lich-like quality, haven't they?
Yeah, it's very skull-like, very
skeletal. They've lost
the
cartilage part of the nose. They've just got the skull bit. And then they've got the very tight skin, which is very like demi-lich, if you know what I mean. That's kind of what 100%. It feels like, and how they're sort of spoken about. Whilst the Gisarai,
they've got big heads.
Big head for the brains. Humanoids. Yeah, exactly. But just, I've never seen them so differently drawn. Whilst today's art, they are drawn similar.
I didn't see any talk about what leader the Gisarai have, because in fifth edition, in the Gisarai, they have a leader as well who is basically a mummy lord, and they cannot move. There's all psionic power. So they are so old, they just give out their orders through telepathic. And there's, again, there's an absolutely cracking image of them in Mordekainen's Tome of Foes. And of course, neither the leaders like each other, but they're so similar. They've done exactly similar things, just one's a bit more active than the other. And it's just, very, very interesting as a result.
In this, it mentions that the Gisarai still have an uneasy truce with the Mind Flayers.
Yeah.
Which is a different, because nowadays they're all very much against the Mind Flayers. But yeah, so slight interesting differences. Yeah, really, really interesting to see how they came about. And also, just a note before we go, that from that same Snipe and Whip, notice that the name Githyanki comes from a George R.R. Martin story.
I did not know that.
Yes. So the name, actually, and some of the storyline comes from a George R.R. Martin story from the late 70s, which was his sci-fi novella, which had a peoples called the Githyanki who were enslaved by an alien race. And so you can see some, a little bit of the guy who came up with it said that, yeah, I was definitely influenced by that and made it for their own home game as one of the key antagonists for them to be involved with. So I think that was it. So
that's awesome.
Inspired by a bit of a George. So yeah, Game of Thrones link there as well to Gisarai.
Turns out if you read one bit of any kind of book, it'll inspire you to think of your own things and obviously then become one of the best or biggest parts of D&D.
I know, kind of incredible.
Which one would you like to do next?
Well, I'm going to do the Penangalan.
Penangalan, yes. First of all, what a cracking image.
I know. I was just like, that's what it was. And I saw it, I was like, wait a minute. I want to know what this is about. Why is it a head on its own floating with weird bits coming out the bottom of it? And then you're like, is that guts? Oh, it is guts.
It is guts. And then it's flapping through the long hair it has.
It moves with its hair. It has its own lair. Its special attack is Blood Drain. Surprise, surprise, it's a vampire. Now, again, I think you could adjust the genders of all of this. You know, it says a female vampire type undead. Undead of fearsome power and nauseating appearance. This vile creature appears during the day as an attractive humanoid who may be of any character class. I'm going to degenderify this just because I think that's how I'm going to play it.
Please do. Yes, absolutely.
So this is a human which the Penangalan was before death. Yeah. They will fight with the same combat abilities as they had when alive, will have spell use if formerly a spellcaster, thieving abilities if formerly a thief, and so on. They will use the weapon, or at least the weapon type, favored by them in life. Their body will take the same amount of damage as it would before. However, their head will have an additional 4 hit points of damage as a separate account of its needs to be kept in case the head itself is struck in this form. And you go, wait, why is the head so important?
In this form, yeah.
Yes. So there's only one exception. If they were a cleric, they cannot do anything that will be helpful. It says good spells, but I like the idea you could do no like healing magic or anything like that, which I kind of would be, do you know what I mean?
Like, that'd be quite cool if like this particular creature you encountered, it's like, oh yeah, I used to be a cleric, and then go, oh, I'm out of spells, oh no.
You can still use your baneful effects,
he's like, why don't you heal me? It's like, oh, I know.
Well, you're just a cleric in Critical Role.
yeah pretty much. Yeah, yeah.
Like Jester never heals anyone.
It's like, oh, I don't have my first aid box, oh no.
I'm a cleric of a certain god that doesn't have these sort of spells.
Yeah. What I quite liked about this is that, so wherever you encounter them, obviously they'll sort of latch on to a group as like, oh no, you're adventurous, I'll come in with you. And they will have vast knowledge of the area that you find them in. So if you find them in a dungeon, they'll know all the stuff for it. Mm. But then not to give the game away, they'll sometimes do, it says here, deliberate mistakes.
Yeah.
Which I love that as a proper, like, you do something that's really obvious and everyone goes, what?
It's to make them, whose members would naturally become suspicious if their new companion displayed near omniscience of the place.
That's true. They do have, like, full, because they lived for so long,
yeah,
right?
So, so that they don't accidentally, like, how do you, if you know everything about it, why? Yeah, you could be like, I've been trapped down here for days. My adventuring party have been lost. You know, can you help me? And obviously, anytime that happens in a D&D adventure, you're obviously going to be suspicious. I think you could even just do it, though. Just like, maybe I would take one of them, have them as a just a tradesperson who is outside the dungeon or in the vicinity of this dungeon or area, who is just always like, oh, going up the mountain, are we? Gonna go fight the dragon, are we? You know, well, I've been up there many times, you know.
Let me take you.
For a fee, I'll take you, you know. So make it feel like they have to pay for it and stuff like that. And basically, though, what is kind of great about them is that at night, so they will never sleep in the same camp as the party,
which I think would be a difficult one to do, but I like the idea that you just have to be really strong in your boundaries, perhaps. I don't know.
So it will even like move out of the dungeon with the party, but it just at nighttime it will disappear, because at nighttime its head and guts separate from its body
in a vertical move. So it's just like
in a vertical movement. I mean,
incredible
concept. I mean, it's disgusting. And they will fly in search of victims. And the picture of them at nighttime with this like moon behind them is kind of incredible.
That's so good.
And I kind of want to put them into my Omen of the Blood God now, because I think they're amazing. And then what they do is they go and hunt for prey in a very much like a vampire. They will go and they will hypnotize someone. You have to make a saving throw. If you fail that saving throw, they will then stake a bit of your blood, which I think is a certain amount of damage. And that 1 to 5, 8, 6 hit points, so a D6.
Yeah.
And you lose those hit points, as in your hit point maximum decreases by that amount. And they do this every night until you run out of hit points. And every night you get to make the same throw, but the throw gets harder.
Yeah. You don't remember if you survive that. You don't remember what's happened, except like a little bits of flashes and nightmares. What I do like, though, is that if any unfortunate witness the scene of when this creature's head and guts detach from its body, they must make a saving throw against magic or die immediately, which I thought was amazing. Just like the idea, you just go, this is too scary.
Fuck this. Yeah. But if you do save against it, then they cannot, or you break the spell one night, then they can never try and hypnotize you again, and you will be aware of it of all times, and you're sort of safe from them. You will always recognize anyone, no matter what form it's in from then on.
Pretty black and white in terms of like what can and cannot happen. There's a lot to it, but as a result, like you know, like, oh, once they save, all right, this whole stuff, it's not like, ooh, dicey. So I quite like that as a result, but it's quite brutal.
It says, like, again, so if you're degendering it, the point would be that if you do die as after being bitten by one, then you have to make a save or you become one yourself. The internal organs swell up whether feeding takes place or not inside the body, which is
that's
kind of when it's feeding. Which I think is kind of, you come across this body which you think is like
bloated,
decapitated, and then it's bloating and like maybe like I do it like its hand rubs its tummy. Do you know what I mean? Like, yum.
Whether feeding takes place or not, and cannot return to the abdomen until they've been soaked in vinegar for an hour, during which time they return to normal size. So you can tell if you're in one, a lair of this kind of creature, is detected by a distinctive odor of vinegar which permeates it. But I would even say, like, the person that you're with stinks of vinegar. Like, I have that smell going on. You're like, God, they must really like pickles or something.
And it says, if a ray of sunlight strikes creature's head and gut when they are detached from the body, the head will be paralyzed and will fall helpless to the ground until nightfall. Thus, the creature will always attempt to reunite head and body before Crookcrow. In any event, if the head and body are not reunited within 7 hours after the initial separation, both will start to decay and the evil life force within it will be forced to return to hell. Thus, to destroy the body or the head is a sure way of destroying the creature itself.
Amazing.
And it's got it drips a highly volatile and foul mixture of blood and juices, which cause 1d4 hit points of damage on bare flesh.
I want to put this in Curse of Strahd instantly.
You've got to. It is so
evocative.
It's so evocative. It's such a great thing. Stephen Hellman I mean, your name is nominative determinism or what? Do you know what I mean? Like, come on. You've just come out of this with this thing and there's some artwork.
Well, you've opened the gates and like, and yeah, they are in myth and legend as well. I will say that as well. They are. But I think described in such a way and so evocative. Now, obviously, who knows if that's been coffee edited a little bit as well, but I'm just there going like, all the guts just hanging down and maybe pulsating and the heart is still beating. And I'm just like, that is horrific. When can I put them in?
They are from a Malaysian origin, the story of them.
So good.
Which is very really interesting. Yeah, I didn't realise that. It'd be interesting to maybe read up a bit more on their origins of that.
Who knew that learning about folklore in other parts of the world that isn't Western could inspire someone?
So much cooler.
Really? Oh, well, good entry. Well done.
Yeah. Yeah. Back to you then your one. Which one are you going to choose?
I'm going to choose my Disenchanter. Again, I'm like, I choose you, Disenchanter. And then this horrific sort of, I assume incredibly tall, like aardvark type character with long legs as it comes out, like a horse with a long nose, essentially with no mane. And the Disenchanter represents a spindly, and I cannot say this, a dromedary.
Like a camel.
Oh, a camel. That makes more sense. Okay, so a dromedary with a long, flexible and muscular snout that can extend as much as 5 feet from its head in an attack. First of all, it is a pale electric blue in colour and slightly translucent, which again is like, ugh, that's horrible. And sometimes it may even seem to shimmer. But here's the cool thing. It has the power to detect magic, like magic from items and artifacts. So if you've got magical armour or shields or swords and the like, and it feeds on it. If it attacks you, it's not going to go into your pouch and get like the spell scroll that's at the bottom of it. It's going to go for the shield. It's going to go for something that it can see. Mm. And as soon as it latches onto it, it's going to suck out that magic. And then it just becomes a unmarked but completely mundane useless item. It's great. I just think it's so good because you're like, no. I think because people get very, very precious about their magical items. They're like, haha, I'm so strong. And then you take that away and they go, oh, no. I don't think it's necessarily a particularly tough creature. They're very rare. Mm. Usually one or two of them will appear. If you're relying on those magical weapons to have a +3 or a +2 or something like that, then suddenly that goes and then you're now relying on your own statistics. So I just thought that was really, really interesting on that front.
I like just the little thing of like no one has ever discovered its lair nor come to any proven conclusion about its metabolism, which at the least can be described as curious. I thought that was I actually quite like that line.
It's a quite nice, like almost like a David Attenborough kind of like conversation about it.
Here we are, the Disenchanter.
Very rare indeed. The other thing to note is that they can only be hit by magical weapons, but these will not lose their enchantment when hitting the beast. It's only with the snout can it take out things. So I like that idea that it is a directed force, almost like an anti-magic sort of cone that you sort of see.
I'd give it a reaction once per turn to try and parry.
Oh yeah.
And if it fails, it can actually redo it until it succeeds. I'd say it once.
Well, that's a cool move. I like that.
You know what I mean? So like, maybe it's only like partial armor class or something like that, but I would like that as an optional rule. Maybe it's just once per turn it can use it just to try.
It kind of reminds me of, we talked about them a little bit in our travel book club just now, the Zorn. These creatures that love gems and they have a sense of like being able to sniff it out. So I like the idea that these things are also always hungry and they're like, get little horrible sort of like elephant style, like trunk comes around and sniffing. And then it just goes straight for your cool magical sword or shield.
Yeah.
I can just imagine, it goes on your helmet and you're like, and it's trying to, you think it's going to get you. And it's like, no, it's just sucking the headband of intelligence or something like that. So yeah, so it's quite a short entry, but I just thought it was just so weird that I was like, this is cool. What's your final one that you're going to share with us then?
The Revenant then, which is also by Stephen Hellman. It's an undead creature, but with an interesting backstory. So like the last one, I kind of see that as being something you could bring into your campaign as a little trickster character, someone to fool the party or to at least be, and you know, something that they're constantly talking about, is this person on the level and all that stuff, which is kind of just a good thing just to add to any, you know, just to spice up the game a bit more. But the Revenant is, under exceptional circumstances, those who have died a violent death may return from beyond the grave to wreak vengeance on their killer as a Revenant. There are few that can make this journey. To do so, a dead character must have a wisdom or intelligence greater than 16 and a constitution of 18. Mm-hmm. All the characteristics must sum up to 90 or more. And if both these criteria are met, the chance of a character becoming a Revenant after death is 5%. So it's a D20. It's a natural 20, basically.
Wow. Okay.
I'd adjust that a little bit, offer up to any character and suggest that if you can roll a death saving throw or something like that, maybe. And if you succeed one of your death saving throws, even though you fail, then you can have this opportunity, is what I would suggest.
Yeah, I think so.
If you've made one success during your Death Saving Throws, or maybe two successes, you definitely, maybe adjust the DC based on that. So maybe it's like,
it's definitely something like a dark gift could come into this.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
You said whether you failed them all, or if you said one or two, that you caught the notice of some dark power who comes to you, like everything, time stops and goes, I can help you.
Yeah.
Do you want this chance?
Yeah, exactly.
And your time's not up yet, but I could do something.
Yeah.
But it might not be what you want. So yeah, I really like that. Especially if it's a violent death, which probably will be.
That's what's kind of fun about it. I think it's just a great little thing to add to your characters. They look like a decaying human though when it happens.
Yeah, the image of them is terrifying.
Yeah. And they sort of like meld and morph into, like, so if you cut off their limbs, their limbs will crawl along and rejoin and form back to them. Like, maybe even just making that someone that your characters maybe take out as to come back again. And you've got to fight the revenant version of them, which is really cool.
Which makes sense, because then they're locked onto you. This idea that the revenants can also stare into their killer's eyes, and that person must make a saving throw against magic or be paralyzed with fear for 2 to 8 rounds. So if you manage to kill that sort of mid-level boss or whatever, and they've come back as a revenant for whatever reason, and you're like, oh no. And then you're frozen in terror for 8 rounds of combat. That's
a long time. That is a long time.
I love it. I love it.
Also, turn undead doesn't work. Holy on the holy symbols doesn't work. Holy water doesn't work, because they're not considered evil inherently, which I thought is an interesting thing, that turn undead means that all undead are evil, which I thought I didn't know. But I just see it, turn undead doesn't work, which is kind of cool. Weapons, normal and magical light, do not affect the creature.
That's right.
The only surest way to kill it is to reduce it to ashes. Like, you know, so it's like, this is something that you're like, players are just like, what the fuck? You know?
How do we kill it? How do we get through it? Absolutely.
It doesn't take any damage. You chop its arms off, it reforms. It will, after 3 to 6 months of rebirth, it will compose rapidly, and the spirit will be forced to return to the plane from whence it came or is meant to destine for.
So it's a short period of time, but it has to be motivated to find.
Exactly. Yeah.
Its mode of attack is to lock its claw-like hands around its victim's throat and then strangle them. So I like the idea that it might have a sword and then just pulls it aside and it's like, no! Just the physical act of like going, oh, how could you?
Yeah, it will never resort to the use of weapons. It's like
so
literally a visceral death, which is kind of quite terrifying in that way.
Yeah, unstoppable force. I love it.
It's associated with the killer with the party they will be dealt with after the killer has been destroyed. So anyone who was involved in their death or was part of that is also under their guise, and it has a corpse-like appearance, heavy and dull-lidded. If the character who became a revenant died, it may be able to reoccupy its former body when it becomes a revenant, instead of just being this spirit that will occupy any available freshly dead corpse, which is not great. Lots of lines and veils to have here, but the killer will always see you in the form that you had in its former body, and see it as it is, as if it not had been involved in the killing. So the person who killed you, you will return as if you were alive and well, you know, which I think is kind of great. You know,
that's
sort of
good.
Like turning up and just the, you know, like what a characterization. Like if you have a character in a final act or arc who passes away in there, what a way to bring them back maybe for the final, like, maybe it's been like a few episodes, like sessions or something like that, and you're in the sort of end game and the other players picked up a new character or something like that, or has just left the game for a bit maybe. And then in that final battle, bam, the doors open. There standing is this, and you're just like, fuck, yes.
It's like the worst return of Aragorn you can ever imagine.
Exactly. Yeah. And once it's done, it will disintegrate and will never return again. And its spirit rests in peace at the end.
It is so focused. Its motivation to get the killer is just, it is something that I'm like, oh, I really want to play with that in a game and see what the players make of it as well.
And then what's your final one then?
Okay, so, you know, again, the random rolls have been okay on this. There are some in here that's like, oh, an urchin, which is like a sea urchin. And there's like a, you know, deaf dogs as a player. But here we have something called a throat leech.
Great bit of artwork here. It's very, like, punky. It's not very, like...
It's not very fantasy, is it?
It's not very fantasy. It's like a bloke who looks like he's holding a spray can, I think. Or ink bottle, maybe.
It's supposed to be water of some sort, I think. But so this is created by Ian Livingston, as you said.
I wonder if that is Ian Livingston in the artwork.
Well, that's what I thought as well. I wondered if they'd... I don't know. It was one of those things where I was like, this is not like the others. This leech is about 1 inch long and represents a resemblance, an inconspicuous twig, which I'm already like, what? And it is always found in fresh water, so streams, pools, etc. Anyone drinking water containing a leech may, 10% chance, take it into their mouth until the water is carefully filtered before drinking. The leech will then fasten itself onto the soft flesh at the back of the victim's throat. Obviously, content warnings, here we come. Sucking blood at a rate of 1 to 3 hit points of damage each melee round until it becomes completely distended after about 10 rounds of sucking. The leech will be bloated and will not suck any more blood, so you will then basically have a choking hazard at the back of your throat. Each melee round that the leech is in the victim's throat, there's a 50% chance that the victim will choke, causing an extra 1 to 4 points of damage. And if they choke 3 successive rounds, they will die at the third choking. Apart from magical means, which may suggest to themselves, the only way to kill a throat leech in the victim's throat is to place a thin, heated metal object, which I think is just wildly like hold still as you're like rushing around with this horrible like thing in your throat, as such a wire into the bloated leech, and the hot metal will cause it to burst. And no further damage will be inflicted on it. However, the person administrating the cure runs a risk of burning the victim's throat for another 1 to 4 hit points rather than the leech. The success of a successful probe is about 5% for each dexterity point the person making the attempt is. So if you've got a really good sleight of hand or a really good dex stat, you should be better. Mm. But again, this sort of encounter, I can imagine that you're just doing some downtime. You're about to do a long rest and you're just drinking some water and somebody starts to choke. What do you do as players, as adventurers who've never come across this thing before? Like, you know, you maybe do the Heimlich maneuver, that's not working. Mm. You might have to do a perception check to see there's something in this person's throat. I don't think I would be smart enough to try and burst it. That sounds like the worst thing in the world. I maybe like I'm like thinking tongs to try and pull it out, but that could be even more dangerous.
Well, I always think you burn a leech, don't you? That's what you do. You burn leeches.
Is that
what,
that's
how you get them off. Like, so if you have a leech, like on, I remember when I went, if you go to France as a kid and we went traveling, we did like a DUV there. Loads of people went in the water and our legs, well, we walked through this water and all our legs are covered in little leeches.
No.
What? And so they had to burn them off. That's how you get them to stop holding on to you.
I never...
Lots of like countryside walks in France. By the way, don't go wading in shallow water because you will get leeched.
Oh,
I have been leeched by like about 7 per leg.
Oh.
Yeah, the tiny ones, though. They're probably...
I didn't think they were a thing anymore. I've got to be honest. This is how wild my...
They're just out of the wild. And dogs get them quite a lot as well. Ticks more likely. But leeches, like, in water. Yeah, lots of, like, shallow river water.
Gross.
Yeah, so... by the way.
What does it say? It says, like, between 1 to 6. So maybe everyone in the party gets a couple of them. I don't know. But it's one of those things where it's unlikely to happen whilst you're in the middle of, like, a big combat. It's more like, we're going to take a rest. Cheers, everyone. What a successful mission. You know, like, I hadn't even considered, like, having a combat like that. That is not like, wait, just, I heard a snap of wood. Something's approaching us. It's already here. It's already in your water thing. It's Yeah, again, a nice short one, but he doesn't need any more explanation of that. You can see this person's choking, and as they open their mouth, you can just see there's just blackness. You're like, what the hell is that at the back of their throat? Yeah. Again, lines and veils. If you don't like it, that's totally fine. But I was just like, that's so different. I hadn't considered it.
Is there anything, like, any other two mentions, like also-rans that you wanted to mention quickly?
I mean, to be, I'm very bad because as soon as I see a fun name, I'm like, oh, what about that? But then I it's always one of those things where I'm not so sure, like the carbuncle, which I was like, what is that? You know, like, and so there's stuff like that. I like the sound of like the fire drake, flail snail. I've seen before in D&D. They're brilliant. I really think they're great. Needleman was quite an interesting one, where basically that is a zombie like creature, and it just goes and it does basically like a porcupine sort of spread of needles. But yeah, again, one of those things where I think I can imagine coming back to this book over and over again and picking out, going, what about this one? What about this one?
One of my favorites was the Sandman, which was, it's just a man who's made of sand, and if you get within 20 feet of him, you must save magic or go to sleep. They won't do anything to you. They won't. They will just let you doze and look after you. And then, unless you're in their lair, where they will eject you first. And that's it.
I like the idea. They're like, oh, not again.
Yeah.
Okay.
Like, this poor person. Like, I like the idea of the sad man who's like, finally, someone saved. I can talk to someone.
Oh,
yeah.
You mentioned it as like a jokey one. I hadn't realized it was a proper jokey one. And that's quite
go.
That's
you just cool. Get put to sleep.
Yeah, overall, I think my sort of review of it is sort of the initial, like, aside, there is some bits in here I'm like, oh, that's really interesting. And you could obviously tell it's obviously different contributors and stuff, and there's different flavors and stuff as well. Some of it feels a bit more dense than others because obviously they've got a bit more mechanical stuff, which is obviously meant for first edition D&D. I like some of these things. Where can I use this? What can I put this in? And I know you picked quite a lot of horror stuff. I picked some absolute random one that just takes magic. That's
like
some fun one. And then, the throat leech as well. So I definitely see the amount of work that's got into it. And I was talking about Dragon Plus magazine before it was retired. They used to do things like, next month we're doing mist talismans. Why don't you submit a 2-line thing about what it looks like, or magic item of some sort, but it's like 2 lines. Any suggestions would be published, but the winners would have their stuff actually drawn by a D&D concept artist.
That's great.
Which I thought was great. And again, obviously it's a digital publication. Who knows if it would be used elsewhere, but I just thought that was something like that was just really interesting. As like, every month here's a prompt, here is a theme. What do you suggest? What would you expect to find in a Dragon's Hoard when they did Fizzbands, for example, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So just to tie it in with release or tie it in with certain activities or events going along in the Wizard of the Coast D&D world.
Yeah, it is a shame that it's those sorts of things that there's no constant magazine going on, which is kind of, it's a shame. I know we get a lot of that going on because people just release stuff, but
yeah,
it's nice to have something that's old-fashioned media in a certain way, only because of, not because I want old-fashioned media, but there's something about it being edited and
yes,
curated that means that you can find some really cool things. That was all. So I kind of like that.
Well, Hamilton, thank you so much for introducing this to me, because again, I had no idea it existed. And yeah, definitely something I'd come back to have another look through. And if I had more time, just like look through all the ones that have weird names rather than just randomly rolling and just hoping for the best. Where else can we find you? What else is going on in your life, Hamilton? What projects are on the horizon?
What projects on the horizon? Well, so you can find me on my YouTube channel, Fueled by Chaos, where I've been doing some kit bashing. My next kick bash, I'm going to have two on the go at the same time. One of them is a little metal character, the one that I showed you that picture of earlier from the White Dwarf cover.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But also, because I'm going to be doing some role-playing games with Fiona and Taylor in our Adventures in Mordheim. Yeah, it's going to be taking Siegfrieda, which is Fiona's character.
Yep.
I can't remember Tay's character's name. It's gone.
Well, every time we come to it, it's a different name every time.
It's a different, very long Muselhurst the Third sort of name.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So Siegfrieda is a witch hunter, and Tay's character is a noble with an extortionate amount of names.
Well, come watch the Kit Bash video and you can find it.
Yeah, exactly. And so I'm going to be putting together some minis using some famous witch hunter minis that you can get. But
so I've been excited.
Before I got onto this chat with Fiona, I was looking through my bits box to get all the heads. I've got a box of little heads to go through with Tay later today to say,
so
which
funny.
Head do you like? Because she said, I want a pretty boy. And yes. I'm like, there's not a lot of those.
Yeah, weirdly, they're all sort of like gruff, etc. So
the head itself might be as much of a kit bash as the rest of the body.
Hey, cool. What a challenge.
Exactly.
Cool. Yeah.
Working
yeah.
at such a scale. That will be starting in April, the actual show, but I'll be kit bashing over the next couple of weeks.
Nice.
And that'll be coming out soon. I mean, apart from that, you know, Demon Slayer and Blood Omen, I'm going to do a little update today because I just want to show people some of the new stuff. Mm-hmm. And that's set to be on scale for going out in April. But what, why, when, and where?
I just like that you looked at me like straight at the camera and I was like, oh God, is he okay? Yes. What? Hello, me. Hi. Where? Currently in the UK, but soon not to be in the UK. Ooh. When?
Very exciting.
It's almost April, but it's not April. But then where? I am so glad you asked. Where is What Am I Rolling? Which is a twice monthly tabletop RPG one shot podcast. As always, it's going very, very well.
Very well.
Lots of interviews with game designers coming out just now. I do want to highlight one that came out very recently. Hopefully by the time this comes out, the Kickstarter will still be going. I got to interview the wonderful Taylor Navarro.
Oh, yeah.
Lovely, amazing TTRPG writer and project manager and editor. They've got their new Kickstarter called Not Yet, which is the idea of a romantic duet RPG, essentially, where the system, all it is that you both roll at the beginning of each scene a D6, and if the numbers match, your characters meet, but it's at the wrong time. And the idea is that you do several scenes, almost like just missing or right person, wrong time, that sort of aspect, where in the final scene, you decide whether your characters get together or not. And that could be a romantic thing, it could be a platonic thing, but it's about creating that relationship between two characters. Maybe one of the characters is always leaving something for the other, so you're finding out bits of their information about them. It's a bit like if you seen One Day, that's quite big now on Netflix just now, that idea that you meet on the same day, or you see the characters' lives on the same day for 20 odd years and stuff like that. So it's just something very different. It could be just that one-off story, or it could be like we want to create backstories for two characters in a different game. And it was an absolute joy to talk to Taylor, so I just wanted to really shout that from the rooftops.
Oh, awesome. There we go. Cool.
All right, well, with that out of the way, thank you so much for listening, folks, and we will see you on the flip side.
Bye-bye. Thank you.